Thank you. Okay, basically, I know you guys learned Baba Kama, right? I was right about that.
Okay.
So I was trying to think of like what to talk about in Baba Kama that wasn't like an actual Baba Kama sugya, because I don't think anybody want to learn Baba Kama at like 6:43 at night after spending the whole day learning Baba Kama. But the problem is that there's very limited amounts of Agadata in Baba Kama, and all the ones that exist you probably heard already. Like the Mahadran Gemara Daf Tes, you probably did the Brisker Rav about Neros Chanukah and Mahadran. I'm assuming you did that before, and it's also a month after Chanukah, so I'm like not gonna talk about that. Gemara Daf Lamed about Mila de Brachos, Mila de Nezikin, Mila de Avos. You probably heard the Gemara quoted like the first day of Yeshiva, I imagine. No. Any of you? Okay, whatever. That's like probably the most famous I got in the entire Masechta. So I'm like, let me go to the very end of Baba Kama. I'm assuming that no one made it there. In Daf Tzadi Beis, there's a whole bunch of Agarata about Avraham and Sarah. And you probably have heard all these Gemaras just because Rashi and Chumash quotes basically all of them, but you probably didn't know they were in Baba Kama. So I'm kind of using that as an excuse to give this year. That's kind of what I'm saying. This is not at all a Baba Kama year by any stretch. It has nothing to do with Baba Kama. It's really a Chumash year, but I'm just using Baba Kama as like an excuse to give this year. So basically, I know it's already after Sefer Bereishis, so it's a little bit like not so timely this year, but whatever, it's still Torah. So, b'di'evet, it still counts. So anyway, basically, the topic we're going to talk about tonight is whether the Avos and Imos were perfect. And that sounds like, okay, like, meaning, I assume a lot of you know from many Rishonim and from Gemaras that the Avos and Imos seemingly did Averos, right? We know this already from the Ramban, says this in a bunch of places, the Ibn Ezra, a lot of Mefarshim on Chumash make this point pretty clearly. But as we'll see, there's one Mefarish who very, very adamantly believes that the Avos and Imos never, ever, ever, ever sinned. And every time that the Ramban says they sinned or the Ibn Ezra says they sinned, he spends pages and pages trying to reinterpret the entire story. So we're going to hopefully go through this parish, but before we get to the actual stories in Sefer Bereishis, I just want to give you a little bit of like a historical background about who this person was so you can kind of appreciate everything he says. So the person we're going to learn about, his name, the Sefer that he wrote was called the Haksava HaKabbalah. His name was Rav Yaakov Tzvi Mecklenburg. He lived in Germany. He was born in, I think, 1755, and he lived into the mid to, early to mid 1800s. He was, for those of you who have ever learned anything about Jewish history, so you know that time period was very heavy of, orthodoxy fighting against the Reform and the Haskalah and all that stuff. So he was very much in that mindset, very like Chasam Sofer-esque, very Rav Hirsch-esque, if that resonates with you at all. He was also a Talmud Rebbe Kiva Eger, I believe. He quotes him a few times in his Sefer. Basically, he spends the vast majority of Sefer Bereishis reinterpreting all the stories that you have known probably since first grade and telling you this is not what happened in the story, or whatever you think happened is not actually what happened. So with that in mind, let's start going through some examples. So probably the first example in all of Chumash, in all of Tanakh, where we find seemingly someone doing an Avera, and I'm not talking about like Adam Chava Kain, I'm talking about like the Avos and Imos doing an Avera, when Avram comes down, or at the time, Avram comes down with Sarai, right? When they're confronted by the Mitzrayim, so they say, Imri na achosia, right? Basically, Avram tells Sarah to lie about the fact that they're married, right? That's the first, probably most famous example. So right off the bat, we're confronted by an obvious problem, which is, how was he allowed to do that? How was Avram allowed to lie about Sarah? So the simplest answer is, what do you mean? It was pikuach nefesh. So obviously, that's why it was mutter, because he thought he was going to get killed for it, right? That seems pretty obvious from the psukim. However, Rav Mecklenburg is not into that idea, and he completely and utterly reinterprets the entire story. And as we'll see, he gets very creative about how he reinterprets things, because you have to be if you're going to reinterpret all of Sefer Bereishis, basically. So he starts by pointing out the following. He says that Avram and Sarai at the time, so we know from Gemaras that the Avos and Imos, for the most part, kept the Torah, but we also know that there are obvious problems with that, like how could Yaakov marry two sisters? How could Amram marry his aunt? Right? Those are like the probably most famous kashas that the Achronim ask. There's a very famous comment from the Nefesh HaChaim when he talks about this, where he basically says that the Avos and Imos basically kept the Torah, except where, for some reason, in like the Mazalos or Kochavim or their own Cheshbonos, they felt that it wasn't appropriate at the time to keep the Torah. The Nefesh HaChaim says if you try to do that today, then you're in violation of multiple Yisurei Doraisa and potentially Chayiv Misa, depending on what you're doing. But the Avos and Imos, they were, because they weren't, because the Torah had not been given yet, so they could make those kinds of Cheshbonos. However, Haksav HaKabbalah says the following, and you might, I don't know if any of you ever learned Kiddushin before or ever opened up a Rambam in Hilchos Yisurei Bia, the very first halacha. You might have heard this Rambam before from high school, right? And the Rambam talks about how Kiddushin worked before Matan Torah, right? The Rambam basically says, Pogea Isha Bashuk, right? Man and a woman met in the marketplace, and like, okay, we're getting married, we're living together, and that's it. There was no Kiddushin, there was no Chuppah, there was no anything. It was just, you decided to live together, and divorce was the opposite. You just decided to not live together. That's basically how it worked. So he points out as follows. He says that even though it's true that the Avos and Imos, generally speaking, try to keep the Torah to the best of their ability, when they felt it necessary to not do that, they decided not to do that. So essentially, when Avraham said, Imri la, I mean, he said, Imri Nachus. Yeah, what he was basically doing is he was changing Sarah's status and saying we are no longer married, because as we just mentioned, according to the Rambam, prior to Matan Torah, there was no get that was necessary. There was no formal act of divorce. You just said we're no longer living together. So according to the Haksav HaKabbalah, the statement of Achusiat is the halachic equivalent of Avram divorcing Sarah. That's what he claims, which therefore means that Sarah is no longer an Ishus Ish, right? Which means that he's not really lying about her status. Now, and we know also that Avram himself, in the Psukim later in the Chumash, points out that they're kind of sort of brother and sister, right? He actually makes that ha'ara later on in the Psukim. So that part is not really a lie. The part that we thought was a lie was the fact that they were married. So comes this idea of pre-Matan Torah divorce and says, well, we're not really married anymore because I just declared that you're my sister and no longer my wife. That's the first thing he points out. He also points out that there's a very technical issue with giving a get, which I don't fully understand exactly why this is an issue, but he basically says we know that one of the requirements for a get is that you have to write the name of the city, right, the name of the river in which you live. So he claims that since Avraham and Sarah were always moving around, they didn't have like a set place that they could even write in a get. Which is like, okay, I mean, this is like pre-Matan Torah. Like, I don't know if the get had to conform to every single, like, din derabanan and every little nuance that a get has today. I'm not sure. But that's one thing that he claims. Also, he points out, interestingly, that since this divorce, this supposed divorce that Avraham declares Sarah to no longer be his wife, is only a pre-Matan Torah thing, but al-P standards of, post-Matan Torah, they're still halachically married. He says, when Avimelech, basically attacks Avram and says, how could you lie to me about this? V'hi bu'ulas baal, she's a married woman, so he wasn't really lying about that, because halachically, al-pi ha-Torah, she really was a married woman, right? It was just based on this like newfangled halacha of pre-Matan Torah that they were now considered to be divorced. One other ha'ara about this story, he has a very interesting point here, which again, I don't think this is really pshat, but this is how he kind of reads into the psukim. When the pasuk says, Imrina achosias. So what is Imrina? So pasuk pshat means, say that you're my sister, right? But Imri, he says, is the word amira with an aleph, so it means to say, to speak, obviously, but he claims that it also comes from the word temura, to change your status. Imri, by this declaration of achosiat, I am now changing your status to no longer be considered an Ashes Ish, which is a really, really mechudish way to read that pasuk, right? Very mechudish. He quotes other examples in Tanakh. There's a pasuk from Yeshayahu that talks about branches of a tree with the word amir, with an aleph, referring to branches of a trunk of a tree that after they die, they regrow. So in other words, the word amir can also refer to something which comes in place of something else. Okay, so again, that's kind of the first example in Chumash. That's the first example that he has to kind of reinterpret. The next story, which is a pretty glaring one also, is the whole Avram Avinu Bama Eida Ki Irashena, right? Avram seems to question HaKadosh Baruch Who question his promise that he's going to get Eretz Yisrael, he's going to have kids, right? That whole story. So basically, the Haksav HaKabbalah has a number of issues with this whole story. So first of all, he asks, why would Avraham care about whether Eliezer would inherit him or a kid would inherit him? Like, we're seemingly the Pesukim are talking about physical possession. So he obviously assumes that this pasuk is not talking about schar olam hazeh or physical reward, but rather the schar that you get in olam haba. Also, this is a question that. I'm pretty sure none of you are married. Is that a fair statement to make? I'm assuming, right? So he asks a question here, which I don't know if, as a married person with kids, is a very hard question to understand. Like, it kind of like pulls at your heartstrings a little bit. If you don't have kids, you might not appreciate this question as much. But he's like, how could Avram possibly value children more than Schar Olam Haba? Which, like, okay, like if you think about it, like conceptually, okay, fine. I understand the question, but like when you have a kid, like it doesn't, like nothing, like, I, like, as much as Schar Olam Haba sounds awesome, having a kid is more awesome, I think. Whatever. Anyway, so that's his question. He also has another kash, which he doesn't answer, which I think is probably one of the best kashes in the entire Sefer Bereishis, which is Avram and Sarah are getting nervous the older they get that they're not going to have kids. If you ever look in the beginning of Sefer Bereishis, people are having kids at like hundreds of years old, right? Avram is only 75. Like, why is he freaking out that he's not having a kid yet? In fact, his father Terach was 70 when he gave birth to Avram. So it's like, it's a little bit of a pella that Avram is so concerned because of his age, right? That's a kasha that he kind of just throws out there, but doesn't specifically answer. So he points out that when Avram says this, this phrase, Hashem Elokim matiten li vanuchi holich hariri, and he says Bama idaki rashana, which we'll get back to in a second. All of those statements, according to the Haksav HaKabbalah, were not questioning HaKadosh Baruch Hu, even though the Gemara Megillah says beferish that he was, but rather they were statements of exclamation, right? Bama idaki rashana, like, look how fortunate I am that I'm going to inherit Eretz Yisrael. Like, look how amazing it is that I'm going to have children despite my age. And he even says that the word hein li, hein is milashon hana'a, right? I'm getting this tremendous benefit, this tremendous pleasure from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and he says, Hein li lo nasata zara. I'm going to derive benefit from Hashem, even if I don't have kids, because I know that that's what HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants from me. And he says, maybe it could be that if I do have children, they're going to turn out to be Rishayim, which we know one of his kids did turn out to be a Rasha, right? So Avraham was essentially saying, I'm being meshabi my ratzo, and I'm being meshabi my will to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Whoever HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants, that's what the end result has to be, which is obviously an incredibly high madriga for any person to say, right? To say, I don't care about my own personal needs. If Hashem doesn't want me to have kids, if Hashem doesn't want me to have X, Y, or Z, I'm just going to let everything slide because Hashem knows what's best, is a very difficult thing to say. It's like imagine the equivalent of walking into a shiva house of a parent who just lost a kid saying, oh, this is for the best. Like, you can't say that because, like, who are you? Like, but that's essentially what Avram is saying, right? That's basically what he's saying here. Like, I know, I don't get it, but this is what HaKadosh Baruch Hu obviously wants from me. So that's another point regarding Bama'ida Ki Rashena and regarding Matitinli, as we mentioned before. Okay, moving on to, this is probably one of the most difficult, in my mind, difficult reinterpretations that the Haksala Kabbalah has in a lot of the stories in Sefer Bereishis, which is the whole story, the whole struggle between Sarah and Hagar, right? The pasuk says, "Vate'aneha Sarai vativrach mipaneha." Right? Sarah, and the pashup shot, Sarah afflicted Hagar, right? And as a result of her afflicting Hagar, Hagar ran away, and then she encounters the Malach. Malach tells her to go back eventually, right? And the Ramban, very famously on that pasuk, writes that the reason why, even to this day, we are being punished and tortured and whatever by the Arabs is because of the way Sarah treated Hagar. Right, the Ramban very explicitly faults Sarah for what's happening to us thousands of years later, and the Haksava Kabbalah is very, very bothered by this. I'll just read you the lashon because it's so striking. He says, "Umize yachriach es haRamban." Like, who forced the Ramban to explain pshat this way? And then he goes on to say, "Ula haashim es Sarah imenu," to fault, to make Sarah guilty. Like, he is so set on the idea that, of course, the Avos and Imos could never have done anything like this. So the question is, what does the pasuk mean? It still says Vate'aneha Sarai. So he says, what the pshat is that Sarah felt that Hagar was getting a little bit too arrogant because, she had a kid before Sarah did, right? So she was putting her in her place. Because since Hagar was a shivcha, right, so she has to show respect to Sarah. So Sarah, she wasn't torturing Hagar, she was trying to regain the balance of power. Like the Rambam says, if a person has a bad midah, you have to go to the opposite extreme to get back to the middle. That's kind of like what he claims Sarah was doing to Hagar. So meaning, even though she might have been acting in a semi-extreme fashion, but it was all for the purpose of getting back, to that, equilibrium, that middle ground. Which again, not only is that not pshat in the pasuk, it's explicitly against the Ramban. But he doesn't seem to care because he's like, yeah, the Ramban is faulting Sarah Imenu, so obviously that's not right. And again, as we'll see as we go on, a lot of these rayas that he brings are really like I think that a lot of these things he would have said regardless of whether he found a raya to this in the psukim. He would have just said, how could the Ramban fault Sarah for any of this, and just stop right there. He tries to support what he says with rayas and with dikdukim and whatever, but I think he would have said it regardless because he's very, very, very set on this notion that the Avos and Imos obviously never did an Avira. Okay. Okay, fine. So that's in terms of that part. Okay, this is probably also one of the harder stories to reinterpret, which is effectively all of Parshas Toldos, right? Parshas Toldos has two major stories in it that are very difficult to understand if you take this approach. The first, of course, is Yaakov with the Bechorah, and then Yaakov with the Brachos, right? Those two stories are like glaring. How could you not call that cheating, lying, whatever you want to call it? So in terms of the first story of Yaakov, quote unquote, stealing the Bechorah from Esav, He spends pages and pages developing this idea, but I'll just give you the very brief overall summary. He basically says that once Esav asked Yaakov for the lentil soup, he gave him the soup right away. There was no deliberation. There was no, give me your bechorah and I'll give you the soup. None of that. Yaakov gave him the soup, and that was the end of the story. What happened afterwards is that Esav started to be mevaza the bechorah, right? He started to speak in a way that led Yaakov to believe that he didn't really deserve the bechorah, and only then did Yaakov take action. In other words, Yaakov wasn't using some kind of a ploy to grab the bechorah from Esav. He saw that Esav basically didn't want the bechorah. In fact, he even claims that Esav effectively was mafkir the bechorah, and Yaakov was just kona the bechorah for himself, which is, again, you have to read that into the psukim. And he says also that Yaakov was only interested in the spiritual benefits, the spiritual aspects of the Bechorah, and not the physical components of Pishnai and all that stuff. He just wanted the spiritual aspects of it. So he basically claims that Yaakov was not being, conniving or whatever you want to call it, when he took the Brachos, I'm sorry, when he took the Bechorah away from, when he took the Bechorah from Esav. He even has a riot to this, because he says that, the Pasuk says, Michrach Hayom es bechoras chalit, right? Sell me, like today, sell me today the bechora. So he says that Yaakov was not taking advantage, let's say, of Esav's hunger. He wasn't forcing Esav to sell the bechora because he was starving for a bowl of soup. So he says that mechrach hayom means that only today he was selling the bechora. In other words, mechrach hayom means the following. It means to say that, in other words, I gave you the soup already. That whole thing is done. And now, because I see that you're being mevaz of the bechora, I want you to sell the bechora to me, separate from the fact that I gave you the lentils, which again is a very difficult shot to read into the sukkim, but that's what he claims. And he also points out that when Yaakov makes Esav swear, right, so it says, hishava li vayishavalo, so the word hishava ends with a hey. The Haksav HaKabbalah has this ha'ara in probably 20 places throughout Tanakh, where he points out that whenever a word, whenever a verb ends with a hey, it's an indication that the act is being done beratzon, as opposed to, let's say, the word hishava without a hey would mean like ba'al karcho. So he says, the fact that the pasuk says, hishavali, swear to me, the implication is that he's swearing willingly. He's not putting a gun to his head and saying, I'm not giving you the soup unless you give me the bechora. He's saying, here's the soup. And also, I want you to swear to me that you're giving me the bechora as kind of like a separate clause, essentially. Okay, so that's how he reinterprets that whole story. In terms of the whole, you know, Yaakov and the brachos story, which is also, you know, obviously a very significant problem. So he first of all points out that, and again, I think this is probably the most pashtut thing that you can say in this whole story, which is that Yitzchak was very misguided in his love of Esav, right? And again, we know this, but we know from the beginning of Parshas Toldos that Esav was a master at tricking his father. Again, the way that Rashi understands kitzayid b'fiv, right? He was tricking him by asking him questions, crazy questions about meister and salt and whatever, right? So he was asking these very, you know, intelligent questions that led Yitzchak to believe that Esav was really this, you know, really frum guy, whatever it was, and that led Yitzchak to loving Esav more. So so this actually fits pretty nicely into the pshat, I would say, because here, Yaakov and Rivka, their agenda was just to make things right again, right? They weren't trying to trick Yitzchak for the sake of tricking Yitzchak. They were just trying to show Yitzchak what was right all along, right? They were just trying to show him what he should have, what he should have known from the outset. The truth is that if you look in the story, right, in the whole story with Rivka basically telling Yaakov to trick Yitzchak, So he points out that everything that Rivka does, and he has a few riyas for this, was done for the purpose of fulfilling the nevuah. Because Rivka, right, she heard the nevuah from Shem in the beginning of Parshas Toldos, right, Viravya Avod Sa'ir. So everything that she did was for the purpose of fulfilling that nevuah. There's actually, I don't know, are any of you doing Daf Yomi? Any of you start with, okay? So the Marsha earlier, like I think it was a week or two ago in Daf Yomi, points out that he has a kasha. The Gemara Megillah says that there were 48 Nevi'im and 7 Nevi'os, right? For those who learn Megillah. So the question is, how could Rivka have Nevuah? She's not one of the 7 Nevi'os, right? How could she have a Nevuah for Rav Yavod Sa'ir? Or similarly, we know by Leah, right? In Parshas Vayetze. Leah calls her fourth son Yehuda. Why? Rashi says, because she was more than her share, and she knew that Yaakov would only have 12 sons, right? How does she know that? She's not one of the 7 Nevi'os in the Gemara. So the Marsha says, you're right, they're not Nevi'os. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu almost put words of Nevuah into their mouth. They were like a conduit of Nevuah. And he says the same thing is true by Avram in Parshas Vayir, by the Akedah, right? When Avram says, Va'ani v'hanar ne'ocharko v'nishtacha v'v'nashu v'alichem, so Rashi says, how did Avram know that he wasn't going to kill Yitzchak? The answer is, he didn't, but Hashem put those words into his mouth. Same idea. So that's kind of a side point, but the point is that Rivka knew about this Nevuah, however she knew about it, v'rav yavod sayir, and everything that she did, every time that she was tricking Yitzchak, basically, was just for the sake of fulfilling this nevuah. That was the whole goal. Everything that she did was simply to make sure this nevuah got fulfilled. And as we'll see, by the way, in a second, this is almost the identical pshat that he gives regarding Yosef and the brothers, right? The question regarding why is Yosef constantly telling them the dreams? Why is Yosef not revealing his identity to them right away when they come down to Mitzrayim? A lot of that has to do because he knew about the dreams that he had and he wanted to make sure that those dreams were properly fulfilled. Okay. Any questions so far? We're good? Okay, great. Okay, fine. Also, just one more point about this. The reason why Yitzchak wanted to give Esav a bracha is because Esav was the Bechor, but once Yaakov acquires the Bechor, and once Yitzchak finds out that Yaakov got the Bechor, so now the brachos were also shayach to Yaakov. And in fact, once Yitzchak realizes the whole trick that had happened, right, so what does he say at the end? He says, right, Gam Baruch Yeh, right? Meaning he essentially agrees to the fact that he gave a bracha to Yaakov and is essentially saying, I'm not going to give that bracha to Esav. Now, the next, really the last part of this particular story, which is probably the most glaring part of the whole story, is when Yaakov seems to explicitly lie and says, Anochi Esav Bechorecha. That is a very difficult, Rashi says, Anochi Esa Bechorecha, right? Which is not pshat at all. But that's what, right? So, because Rashi is also bothered by this issue. Like, anyone can be bothered by a blatant lie. Like, it's one thing to say, okay, you know, Sarah sinned because she, you know, afflicted hunger. Okay, fine. But like, this is three words in Chumash that you basically can't read any other way. But the Haksav HaKabbalah does. So how does he reinterpret Anochi Esav Bechorecha? So first of all, he points out a really interesting thing. He says that the words Anochi Esav Bechorecha were purposely vague. Okay, in other words, Yaakov tried to be as vague as possible so he wouldn't lie, but he also wouldn't twist the truth, so to speak. So he points out the following. He says that, for example, so he quotes from the Rambam. The Rambam says that whenever the word kima, when it's used by Hashem, right? Let's say, for example, atas sakum terachim tzion, right? The word kima in the context of Hashem is a lashon of fulfillment, like being mekayim ashvua, right? It means to fulfill something, right? So he says, Yaakov, he said, this is like probably one of the most wild pshatim you'll ever hear. Anochi Esav Bechorecha. Why is that not a lie? Yaakov was referring to himself as Esav. Why? Why would Yaakov refer to himself as Esav aside from wanting to trick Yitzchak? He says, because you know, Rashi says that the name Esav, the reason why he was called Esav when he was born is because he was made fully formed, right? Esav came out fully formed, you know, he was red, whatever. Yaakov was saying, I am the spiritual Esav. I am fully formed in terms of my midos, my mitzvos, the way that I treat you. I know he's, you know, his kibbutz avim, whatever it was. Anochi Esav. But Yaakov was literally describing himself. He says, Yaakov effectively changed his name to Esav, essentially, which is like a crazy thing to say. He says that his masim tovim, his Torah, his mitzvos, whatever, were Esav. They were fully formed. And he says, and this is like a very subtle diuk, he says, Yaakov says to Yitzchak, when he's still pretending to be Esav, he says, Asisi ka'asher dibarta elai. Okay, so what is Asisi ka'asher dibarta elai? So Haksav HaKabbalah says, in contrast to saying ka'asher amarta elai, because the word amira implies a specific dibur, a specific command, a specific instruction, whereas dibur is just the general idea, you've always listened to me. When Yaakov says, I am Esav, which is really Yaakov, right? He's calling himself Esav, Asisi kasher dibarta elai, I always listen to you. If he said Asisa kasher amarta elai, that would have implied that he was referring to the specific command that Yaakov gave to that Yitzchak gave to Esav to go out and hunt for me, which would have been a lie. And therefore, he changed the word amarta to dibarta, meaning to say, in general, usually, I listen to everything you say. Which is like such a subtle reading of the psukim to come up with a pshat like that. But again, you have to say something like that if you want to be able to read that into this, to read that into the story. And I'll end this section with this one last point that he makes, which I think is so mind-boggling. He quotes the Ibn Ezra. Ibn Ezra says, of course Yaakov did, you know, sinned over here. Because like, anyone reading the psukim would say that, because it looks like he's just straight up lying about the fact that he's not, that he's Esav, right? He says, and again, I don't think he has any raya for this, none that I saw. He claims, which again, I don't think is such a crazy claim, that there are many places in the Ibn Ezra where, you know, some Talmud Toah, some incorrect manuscript, you know, crept its way into the text of the Ibn Ezra, whatever. And he claims, it must have been that some guy, hundreds of years later, wrote this into the Ibn Ezra, because there's no way, how could the Ibn Ezra possibly fault Yaakov for what's clearly not a chet, in his mind, obviously, not clearly in the psukim, right? So he just assumes, he looks at the Mefarshim and Chumash, he sees that the Ramban is faulting Sarah for Hagar, he sees that the Ibn Ezra is faulting Yaakov for lying about the fact that he's Esav, and he says, clearly, this was a mistake in the Ibn Ezra. Clearly, some guy later on added this into the Ibn Ezra, which is like a wild thing to say, because like, first of all, this is like a very standard shot in Chumash, right, to say that the Avos Sinimos sinned. This is not even the most like egregious sin in the world, like to lie about the fact that he was Esav to get the brachos. I mean, it's a problem, but it's not like, you know, it's not the most earth-shattering sin on the planet, and yet he's saying, clearly this was written by somebody else, right? So, again, this is like very much his mindset, right? The Haksalgo's mindset is, clearly they never sinned. Now I'll try to fit everything into the psukim. Right? His starting point is that clearly they never did a chet. Okay, just a couple more points and then we'll wrap up. So the other issue, this is also really interesting, the whole story of Shimon and Levi killing the city of Shechem, right? Which is all the Mefarshim are bothered by this question, right? The Rambam and the Ramban talk about this, maybe because, you know, they didn't have a court system, or maybe because they were passerby in the whole story with Dina and Shechem, right? There are a lot of reasons given in the Mefarshim about how it was justified for them to wipe out the whole city. He has a very creative shot, as you can probably imagine, a very creative way to read that story. He basically says the following. He says that the people of Shechem initially all got bris milas because they wanted to intermarry, they wanted more money, whatever their motivation was. But they eventually realized that once they all got bris milas, they basically separated themselves ideologically from every other surrounding nation. And now all the other nations we're not friendly with them, or maybe even wanted to kill them. And in fact, he says that because of the way the other nations were reacting towards the people of Shechem, they wanted to kill Bnei Yisrael. And he has this really powerful line, which is pretty, you know, pretty pertinent line in the world today, and really in the world all the time. He says, "Ein lecha sina gedola yoser misinas hadas." The greatest form of hatred in the world is hatred of religion, which, you know, is pretty true. So he basically says that because the people of Shechem were so isolated or quarantined by all the other nations after they got a bris milah, they were like, "Why did we do this? Let's kill the Bnei Yaakov for putting us in this position." So according to Aksava Kabbalah, they were completely justified in wiping the city of Shechem out because they were basically rodfim, right? They were basically trying to kill them, essentially. Which again, it's not shot in the psukim, but you know, that shot I could actually buy a little more because the Mefarshim already talk about how to, you know, what was the fault of the people of Shechem. So that's another part about that. And then to end off with the last major topic, which you already kind of alluded to before, which is the whole story with Yosef and the brothers, right? And again, this story requires a lot of reinterpretation. If we can reinterpret this in Chumash, but I would say the most basic point about this is really two things. First of all, and again, this claim I think is very difficult to say, is that the brothers essentially were never really trying to kill Yosef as much as they were trying to, you know, scare the living daylights out of him, essentially. Which is like, okay, I kind of hear that distinction, but like, eh, whatever. But he says this even more powerfully, and there are actually Mefarshim who say this, where the brothers were like this. Listen, if Yosef is really innocent and he really is going to become the, you know, the next viceroy or whatever, so that HaKadosh Baruch Hu will save him. And if he's just lying, so then he deserves to be killed because he's whatever, he's seeking, you know, gaiva, kavod, whatever. So like, oh, let's throw him into a pit. Perfect idea, because then, you know, let everything be left to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Which is like, okay, but it's like it's a very hard answer to say today. It's like okay, I'm going to throw you into a pit, and this used to happen in the 1600s when they had like the Salem witch trials. Like, if you drown, that's a raya that you you were innocent. If you don't drown, then obviously you're a witch. It's like, you can't win. What does that mean? So, you know, again, this obviously, you know, this is like a little bit more like, I probably, you know, above most of our like madrigas about how the brothers, what the cheshbonos of the brothers and Yosef was. The other point that he makes, which I think is very important, which we kind of alluded to before, is that every single thing that Yosef does is for the purpose of making sure that his dreams are fulfilled. Even in the beginning of the story, like, he knows that his brothers are upset when he tells the dream, and he tells them a second dream. Like, why is he doing that? So this is almost like a reverse psychology thing. He says that even though Yosef realized that his brothers were upset after the first dream, he said, well, maybe because the brothers just think that I'm having all these, you know, thoughts, you know, these like aggrandizing thoughts of power and kavod, and that's the reason why I'm saying this. So I'm going to repeat the dream, thereby proving to them that these were not things that I thought about, but the things that HaKadosh Baruch Hu planted into my head. Which obviously backfired on him because it made them even more jealous, right? But in theory, Yosef was trying to convince them that he was doubly fit to become the king and not just, oh, you're just some kid who has these crazy thoughts in his head. Again, and just to end off with this last point, so he quotes from the Chizkuni, which is a really, really odd thing the Chizkuni says, where he says, he claims that the reason why the brothers never, basically never told Yaakov about what they did to Yosef is because they couldn't brag about it. And the Chizkuni says that revenge is only good if you could brag about it, which is like a very weird thing to say, which is what he kind of says on the Chizkuni. He says, and he writes about this Chizkuni, he says, this Chizkuni is like a sword to those people who have seichel, and he says it's bezuya vinim eses. It's like, it's disgusting to say that about the avos. And he says to say that the only reason why the Shvatim didn't murder Yosef was because they couldn't brag about it, he says, it's a little bit crazy, which I agree with. I think that's a really crazy shot to say. But that doesn't necessarily mean that his shatim in Sefer Bereishis are any less crazy. I think they're the opposite extreme, right? Meaning, this is like, I think if you wanted to be very, very like stereotypical about his perush on Bereishis, you would call this like a very charedi way of reading Sefer Bereishis, right? Because it basically is. It's just the avos and imos were perfect. They never said anything wrong, and everyone who says that they did is wrong. Like that's basically how he's reading all of Sefer Bereishis. So again, there's a lot to talk about in here, and it's kind of just the brief points. But that's basically it. Thanks for listening. Yeah,